decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with a hotly anticipated stream each year, and it is The Woodlander. I think The Woodlander probably needs no introduction, but nonetheless, I will ask him to introduce himself.
Hello. Well, I think most people watching will know me. I'm not this little bloke who lives in the woods. And
that would be a funny way to introduce you.
And I've got a YouTube channel, and I started an initiative a year and a half ago, which has gone really well. I mean, it's been a really, really good year this year for me. And interesting. I've learned a lot in the last year.
Well, let's talk about the Woodlander Initiative first. I think it's a good idea to outline that so that people who haven't heard about it yet can maybe get into it. And then we'll talk about what you've learned this year.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we'll get on to the other stuff that we talked
okay.
about.
Okay, all right. Well, the initiative was started really as an alternative to a political route to power. So an alternative to that. And what we wanted to do was to buy land in every single county in the UK. And that land can be utilised by our members. So it's a private members club. You join the club. It's linked to a limited company. And we would have this land and we can utilise it for things like recreation, for growing food, keeping livestock. But it also puts us in a powerful position as an organisation. When you own land in every county, it doesn't need to be every county, but as a large landowner, you can relatively quickly become a multi-million pound corporation, which gives you a lot more clout when you're dealing with councils. I walk into a council as an individual and want to do anything, they probably wouldn't deal with me. But if I walk in as a multi-million pound corporation, they'll have a meeting room put aside for me and coffee and Bourbon biscuits. So it was a way of putting us on a level playing field, which we haven't been for a long time. And I suppose it came about because a lot of people like myself couldn't see a traditional political way forward to gain power. And if we were going to gain power, what was it we actually wanted? And what people wanted was community back again. They wanted to be around people like themselves. They wanted to be able to let their kids out and play safely. All of these things that we understand intrinsically that we can actually do. And the organization was put together, so a private members club, the limited company, then we had to have solicitors on board. Then we raised some money, and then we went and bought some land. And we bought two plots of land in the first year. And when we actually got together on that land, suddenly it became very, very real. So there were single people, there were couples, there was families. There was people who were 18 years old, there were people that were in their 70s. There were children running around, there was dogs running around. It was a really, really incredible thing to see. Everybody wanted to make the place better. They wanted to work. Nobody expected payment. Everybody just wanted to chip in because they felt a sense of ownership. This was ours. And I think what everybody understood was for the first time, for many of the people there. We actually owned something that we were in control of. This was our place. We could talk how we wanted. We could speak. We could relax. We could laugh. We were in control who could come in. And we were also in control of who couldn't come in. It was ours. And people hadn't had that for so long that the feeling there amongst the people that actually got down for those weekends, did a bit of camping, did a little bit of hiking, sat around a campfire and probably drank too much beer in an evening. It was a tremendous thing. And we're now seeing that it's increasing every week. The membership's increasing. We've now got enough money to buy two more plots of land already. So within 18 months, we've gone from inception to a private members club, to a limited company, to buying the first plot of land, buying the second plot of land, to actually getting people down onto that land, to planning things like permaculture, bushcraft courses, the building of toilet facilities, which we discovered the first time you get people onto the land, it's fine for a gang of blokes to go and have a wee behind an oak tree. But when you've got women and children, whatever, so we went down at a weekend and we built the toilets. And that, again, that's just, it's an amazing thing to do, where we just got a gang of blokes together, we go down there and we do the job that needs doing. But the initiative has been an incredible success in such a very, very short period of time. And it's something that everyone can get involved with. All too often on this spectrum in our sphere, things become, well, you can only be part of that one, or you can only be part of that one. And if you're in that group, you've got to dislike that group and this. And we've really got no time for that. So this is a space where everyone can get involved. And we've got members from all different political groups. And everybody pulls together because everybody's on the same page. Everybody understands that this is actually a proactive. It's a positive, no matter what way you look at it, to own our own structures, our own land, our own businesses is a positive thing. And it's something that we can all get involved with.
In this day and age, not just because everything's digital, but because everything's either so much of our lives are virtual, whether it's in the media, whether it's on a text message or on the internet and so forth, even what we're doing right now. And I think in this day and age, for that reason, people can forget that land is still important and that land is still valuable, that a lot still comes back to who owns the land. Do you own any land? You don't, then you have to kowtow to those who do own land. Land is an asset. It's valuable. It's useful. It can be put to any sorts of different uses. And it gives you, therefore, it gives you a degree of independence and power. Would you like to go into that? Because I think this is something that actually needs to be emphasized, because a lot of people, well, like, they don't own property, they don't own land, they don't own anything, as you said. No.
Well, I mean, the whole initial idea was really born out of what I did here. So for people that don't know, most people do, I bought some land, I built a cabin, got some livestock, and then started a YouTube channel and told everyone about it. And a lot of people said, that's great, that's a brilliant way of living. You've got no mortgage, you've got no bills because I'm off grid. I would like to do the same. So I helped people do the same. But then we ran into issues where people said, I want to do the same, but I don't want to do it on my own. I'd like to be in a community of people like me. So, okay, how could we do that? And that's kind of how it started. But I'm going to say something tonight, which I've not really spoken about before. So as well as buying land that we can all use. We have already facilitated in the last year 15 of our members that always wanted to buy land but were never in a position to do it are now landowners. Because by pooling our resources, we could buy a large portion of land that they could never have afforded. We can then portion off that land down to the smallest portion. So if you wanted somewhere that was yours, we can now do that. We can now facilitate that as a company, as a land buying company that has a proven track record. We're already talking to estate agents that are phoning us on a weekly basis saying, we know you, we've dealt with you, we're quite happy with you. What about this piece of land? What about this piece of land? We can buy a piece of land, a large piece, by pooling, let's say, 15 people together, all their money, we'll put some in as well. So we've got an area for members that everyone can use, and then we will chop up. And depending, so we've got people who are now landowners that put no more than £3,000 in, and now they own their own land. And for them, that's what they've always wanted. So there's so many aspects to this. Moving forward, it's part of a much bigger concept, and I think your previous guest's UK column understand the direction we're going to need to take moving forward, which is we're going to need to build things ourselves. Dave Martell, who you had on the other night, was saying exactly the same thing. Right? They've built their own platform. They didn't go to, we're going to set up Hearthfire on YouTube or Odyssey. They said, no, we'll build our own platform. So they built their own platform. They understand that they're a community and they need their own structures, their own systems, and we need to do this with everything. We need to build everything, and we've come so far already. We've already taken over the media system. Alternative media is far outstrips mainstream media. Everybody knows that now. We've got people making films. We've got people doing computer games. We've got people doing publishing. We've got people writing books. All of this stuff we've already got in place. Now we've got groups buying land. Not just in the UK. What we've done is, at the early stages, we've been very successful, and it's getting bigger. But you've also got it in America. You've got it in Germany, you've got it in France, you've got it in Sweden. Previously, you've had on people from the Free Sweden movement, where they started off, they bought a village hall so they could hold a conference. They just thought it'd be handy to have our own hall. Then they bought the pub. Then they bought several businesses. Then they bought some flats. Then they bought some houses. And within 3 or 4 years, they owned the village. But now you've got the villagers around them saying, how come your village is clean, tidy, with no crime? Can you come and can you run our village? So it gets that the more success you have, and when you build an alternative that is an example to everyone else, they'll want to be involved. And that's where we're headed.
It's for the good schools and low crime rates.
Oh,
yeah, I think this is a fabulous concept, and I really hope that a lot of people get into it. Land is almost like the first resource. It's like other than oxygen, you need land in order to do. And this is how it used to be. This is an old fashioned, a traditional idea. Nowadays, you're told, well, no, you can just rent. But then that puts you under the control of the landowner, because ultimately control comes back to he who owns the land. And I think when you described how it felt when you all went to the land that you owned, when you went to it for the first time and stood there, that must have, I can easily imagine that was a very memorable occasion.
It's quite indescribable. It really is, because I could tell you that we all kind of just stood there looking at this huge meadow with a small woodland and a stream, and it's beautiful. And we all kind of looked at each other and were like, this is ours. This is ours. And that's nice because the place is nice. But then it kind of hits home what that means. That means we control this. We're in charge of this. And I don't think anybody there had ever been in that position before. Literally, apart from when you own your own house and you know that you can decorate the walls and you can do what you want. But this is something else. This is much bigger than that. This is, we own this together and we can build something. We can get more of this and we can help other people get this. It really was quite something. And it spurred everybody on to, okay, right, now we know. Now we know not only is it possible, but actually it's really worthwhile. What was really encouraging for me was that this was an idea and we just ran with it and we did it. And then we bought this land and I thought, oh, is anyone ever going to use it? Because it stands on that. It's like, we bought this land and it's, you know, it could be hours away from most people. Is anyone going to use it? Because if they didn't, it was a waste of time. And it's been used every single week. There's been people there since we bought it. And I get messages from people saying, spent three days down on the land, took my boy down for a bit of camping, took the wife down just for a day out. That is exactly what we wanted. That. And then people saying, I've got a really good idea for some permaculture. We can try raised beds for some, and we can do a no-dig area. And I'm like, brilliant. You plan it out, and we'll get down there, work out where we're going to do it. So all of these different things come to the top when you've got it. But until you actually take it from online into real life, nothing gets done. So for me, it's a massive step to go from talking about something. Wouldn't this be a good idea? Wouldn't this be a good idea? Which I see all of the time online, to actually doing it. Yes, it would be a good idea if we owned our own land, if we could grow some food, if we had somewhere we could go, somewhere we could meet in the winter time as well, you know. So we got plans to build a huge barn on there. All of these other things, would it be a good idea? Yes. So let's do it then. Let's just get on and get it done, which is what we've done.
Fantastic. In the simplest terms, how can people get involved?
If you're not on Telegram, hit the website, which is
the Woodlander Initiative. I've linked people to that.
Check it out. Read out what it's about. Membership to join the club is only £10, which is ludicrously low. And once you're a member, you can get into the forums, which are on the website, and you can buy shares, which is how we raise the money. So the members buy shares in the limited company. The limited company, once it's got enough funds, will then go and buy land, and the members have access to any land at any time whatsoever. So, and we're not looking for people to buy thousands and thousands of pounds worth of shares. What we've said is we would like everyone to aim for £1,000. Now, you might be able to do that in one hit. It might take you 2 years. It doesn't really matter. We understand a lot of people are on minimum wage, on low income. They've got high bills. They've got very little money. But if everyone can, so you can buy shares for, they're £1 each, and we sell them in blocks of 10. So if you were to buy 10 shares, you're on your way. And what we've found is a lot of people just buy £10 a month or £20 a month. We had some people come straight in and just bought £1,000 worth, which was brilliant. But it's given us, and the idea is for us to have 1,000 members that put in £1,000, which in the scheme of things isn't that much. But that gives us £1 million. And with £1 million, we can really start to build stuff. We can start to buy land throughout the whole country. And it makes us a very powerful organization.
Yeah, this is it's just very exciting. I hope that people consider getting involved because, as you say, it needn't be a big cash outlay.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and then yeah, every little helps, and it constantly grows, and with that is power, and also just autonomy, independence. Yeah, again, I'm just reminded of the allotment stuff with the government in World War II issued a grow plan for what to do with a small garden. If you had a small garden, here's what you can do with it. And it was
it's quite remarkable.
And the different patches of vegetables and so on is amazing.
Well, I've spoken about this in quite a few videos. It's only really two generations since this was common practice. My granddad, both of my grandparents, the front garden was really the domain of my grandmother's. So it had pergonias and roses, and it looked beautiful, and that was out the front. And out the back was where my grandfathers grew vegetables, runner beans, potatoes, carrots, onions. The back gardens were allotments, and this was always the case. Their fathers did that, and their fathers did that, because why would you go to a shop and buy it when you can grow it yourself? And everybody did it. It was only really my parents that stopped that, right? And they stopped because I think society had got to such a level that they were so affluent, really, that why would I go? And I've heard this argument from people like Academic Agent, who was like, well, why would I go to the effort of buying a bag of seeds for carrots and then spending 2 hours planting these seeds? You know, and at the end of it, some of them die and some of them grow, and I've got 20 carrots. And it's taken me 2 hours to plant them, and then he's done a time and motion study on like how long it took him. And he's like, when I can just go to Morrison's and spend 90 pence for the same amount of carrots. And I think you need to break that mentality. You need to stop that, because that's where my parents were. They were like, well, we could just go to Tesco's and buy potatoes. I don't need to grow them anymore. Sometimes, actually mentioned this in your stream earlier, things can become very, very convenient. And I think as humans, we are hardwired to strive for convenience. But I think that's a mistake. I don't think convenience is always our friend. And things become convenient to such an extent that suddenly you become sedentary, you become less of a human, less of a man, you lose skills, and you're completely reliant on somebody else to provide these things for you. And that's dangerous.
Yeah, Morgoth has written about his experiences of gardening. I think he's having a great time with that. I wish he would write more about it, actually, because he's got a lovely way with words. And well, part of what he said was it was so nice to see the seasons and the cycles and the rhythms of it, and the permanence of it. But I found the World War II plan, that this is it. This is the result of the finest boffins and eggheads that the British government had in 1940. And this is what they put out to people. And it's of interest because it's cute. It's old fashioned. I don't know what the word would be, like rustic, from our point of view today. But I'm sure the exact same plan would work just as well today.
Yeah.
So that's the, you know, when to plant them, how much of it, what you'll need to do it. Very interesting. You can find that easily online, but I'm sure that there are also more advanced, more recent ones that might be better. I don't know. But this is certainly what they were thinking in 1940. Is this something that you might do with the land in the Woodlander Initiative?
Talk about that. Definitely. In every plot we have, there will be areas set aside for permaculture. And when I say that, I mean, that's growing food, maybe livestock. And it depends on where the land's situated and if we have members that are close by for livestock. But we can grow stuff on every single plot. And we can keep livestock on every single plot. And that's important because moving forward, we may have to. And I know people think that might be scaremongering, right? But after what I've seen in the last 5 years, I can't discount anything. And after what's happening now with the farmers, that's premeditated. And that's not to do with inheritance tax or raising money. That's to do with shutting down the farms. And that's dangerous. So if we own our own land and we can provide for ourselves, it puts us outside of their control again. And that's important.
Yeah, yeah. You wanted to talk about the. You said that this has been a very successful year for you. Is there any more that you'd like to say about that? Because you sounded quite upbeat about that.
I am upbeat. I am because I've spent the year really doing stuff that I don't like. Right? So when you start a business, and I didn't want to start a business. I didn't want to, you know, get this involved. I was careful not to become too politically involved with anyone. But I could see the way things were going, and I could see that it needed to be done. And no one was doing it. Even though I tried to push people towards it, no one was doing it. So I had to do it myself. But when you do something like that, you've got to so I spent most of this year talking to solicitors. I don't like doing that. They're so dull as ditch water and mind numbing. But I've learned over the year, there's so much about, you know, how these things work now. So when I bought my land, it was very easy. I found out who owned it. I circumnavigated the estate agent, turned up at his house, and said, I'd like to buy it. And I said, I don't want to deal with your estate agents. I'll buy it off of you. And he was like, okay, yeah, okay, that's fine. And I said, okay, we had a little haggle on the price. I shook his hand. I said, I'll be back tomorrow. I went round with a big bag full of cash, which he was quite shocked at. And I said, look, there's the money. And we counted it out and we signed some forms. And that was it, literally. Buying this first plot of land through solicitors, and you've got to deal with two groups of solicitors, our solicitors and the seller's solicitors, took nearly a year, nearly 12 months, meetings every other week. And on top of those, I've also got a group of solicitors now that work for the initiative. So they're looking at things that, okay, how can we restructure this so that nobody can attack it? So they've seen what's happened. They've looked at that and said, okay, let's make sure everything's nailed down fine. they're looking at how can we access stuff from the government that's handy for you, right, that you can use to fight against the government. They're absolutely switched on. They know exactly what we want to do, and they're a brilliant group of solicitors. But it does mean I'm sat in meetings every other week for hours on end with blokes wearing suit shirts and ties, talking about the intricacies of, you know, finance and business planning, and which drives me mad. But it's worked. That's the good thing. I got an email this morning from our solicitors saying, okay, with a few tweaks here and there, we think we've got the way that you can circumnavigate planning permission on your land, which is an amazing thing. So, yes, it's been a very, very successful year. I can't say any more than that, really. It sounds odd because we don't often hear it in our circles that everything's gone right. Everything's gone right, really. We had that one little bit of bad press from the usual suspects. But even that's nothing. Even that is absolutely has no effect.
It's weird. Quite a few people are saying this this year, that they've been doxxed or they've been smear hit piece written on them, and it hasn't affected them.
No,
that much. Whereas 5 years ago or less, it was quite a big deal. You know, the powers that be were still very. I don't know.
I think the whole doxing thing and the whole trying to make a big deal out of. I think they overplayed their hand. The last sort of 2 or 3 years, they've done it so often that people are now just so blasé about it. They're like, oh, another one, someone else. So what? It's not even news anymore. It literally comes up, and 2 days later, it's forgotten about, which is exactly what we should do, is just totally ignore these people. They're an irrelevance.
I do think that Hope Not Hate seem increasingly sort of feckless, and just like school marms, you know,
yeah,
hall monitors reporting on people, in a pathetic way. Well, it always was vindictive and pathetic, but I think they look like that now, which is great. I'm really glad.
But they're desperately trying to make themselves relevant, literally. And that they're irrelevant. The thing is, they're a state. The state started them. The state funds them, so that it has an independent source, which is when it's not independent. But so they can say, well, we've got this independent source, and it's only against the far right, which is, you know, it's their bugbear. In case these boys do anything we don't like, we have an independent source that can tell us that they're bad, and that's what we can use in the media. But no one's listening anymore. Nobody cares if they call you far right anymore. They've used it so often that it's lost all meaning. So they're just running around trying to make themselves relevant, and they're making themselves look stupid at the same time.
Yeah, and also corrupt. I mean, I think that Nick Lowles did a lot of damage to himself and his organization, Hope Not Hate, when he made pronouncements during the riots. I mean, that's never going to leave him. The fact that what he said and did there. Anyway, no need to go into that. So it's great. As you say, a lot of people talk, and I'm one of them. I mean, I live in my head, and this is what I do. But at the same time, I'm as susceptible as anyone to the depression that induces, where you talk and talk and talk, but nothing ever tangibly changes. So, you know, I thank God for people like you who are more, you know, men of action and practical, and you actually get things done. I think it's great, and I really applaud the project, and I hope more people get involved with it. I hope it goes from strength to strength. So with all of that, is there anything else that you would like to say about the Woodlander Initiative?
Well, this ties into it. So I was asked to give a speech this year, PA's annual conference. It wasn't a long speech, but it was one I thought might get me thrown out of the window. So that was a room with 200 highly politicized nationalists. And I stood in front of them and I told them that everything, every single nationalist political party and organization for nearly 100 years had done had been a complete and utter failure. And I didn't know how that was going to go down. And I spent the first half of that speech reading a list of every single political party and organization since 1942, I think. It's quite a long list. And the truth is that today there's nothing that any of them did that still lasts. All of them failed in what they wanted to do. And what I tried to say is, listen, there's many reasons for this, okay? And some of them are systemic insofar as the system didn't want them to succeed. And there are other reasons as well, which is the makeup of the British and the propaganda they've undergone for now the last 80 years. But you can't keep banging your head against a wall. There comes a time when you've done it once, twice, three, four, five, 100 times and failed every time. You can't do the same thing again. So if that route is shut, we have to look for another route. But I closed that speech with saying, listen, I understand that that's depressing to hear, but there are other ways. If you look at the Return to the Land group in America, and I wish the UK was more like America, within 1 year, they'd bought 135 acres. They've got homes built. They've got a school built. They've got people moving onto that land and living there, working there. They've set up three or four different businesses there. And I know you've got these guys on later on Millennial. And if you want to know about power, they'll have more people living in the town that they're building, that they own, that they control. There'll be more people living there than there will be in the local town or village, which means when it comes time to vote for the police chief, it'll be their guy. When it comes time to vote for the mayor, it'll be their guy. By what they're doing, they're putting themselves in a position where they'll be running the political system in their area, the school in their area, and they own it. They bought that land, they built those homes, and they're getting back to a much more natural way of life. They've got their own livestock, they're growing their own food, they've got their own businesses. This is the way we need to go forward. You've got the Free Sweden movement, where they bought and own this village now, the whole town. They didn't build that. They just started buying it. They moved their members into the area. As more people got involved, they bought more houses. And now they're looking at expanding into the surrounding villages as well. You've got the Homeland Party in Germany. They've just changed their name. But they're looking at doing the same thing. They're looking at buying up land and building their own communities. You've got Orania in South Africa. Okay, and I've spoken to a chap over there as well about maybe coming over to Europe and talking to a group of us about how they managed to get all of these different things in place. This works. This is a positive step in the right direction. So if you can't interact and you can't gain power through the traditional methods, which has been shut off to us, we failed for the last 100 years. Don't try that. Try something that works, because this has proven to work. what they did in South Africa is they said, okay, look, you're not going to let us into that political system. We understand. Okay, what we'll do is we'll buy this land here. We'll build a town. You've now got the government in South Africa asking Urania, how come everything's working so well there, and can you help us? How insane is that?
It certainly is. I just looked, and Urania's population is 2,800. And it's surprising. I thought it was going to be much bigger than that.
Because
it's so famous. I mean, we hear about it all the time, and it's demonized in the press all the time and all of that. But it's only 2,800 people. That's amazing. But obviously it's a very functional, I mean, people will have seen photos and footage of it, and it's a very functional community, town, doing very well. I'll have to get back in touch with the Free Sweden. I'm pretty sure that it's the same organization that you're talking about that was on.
Yes, I think Dan Erickson heads it up.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's who you had on a couple of years ago.
A long time ago. It was like 2018, and then I lost touch with them, and I should have had them on since then. I'll make sure to reach out to him for next year. The American group that you're talking about, I don't know the actual name of it off the top of my head, but it's...
Return to the Land.
Return to the Land. And it's Arvol.
That's right, yeah.
And he's going to be on Millennial on Christmas Eve. Again, he's been on before. At least once. So it'll be interesting to hear from him again.
He put out a video not long back, about a month ago, I think, which is actually thinking along the same lines that we are, which was he was talking about what we've got to be able to do is use liberal democracy against itself. So they've set up this system, which is not working, but in order to do it, they've had to make it really inclusive and everyone can have a bit of it, and there's all these, and we can take advantage of some of those things. And it's the same in this country as well. Like the government in this country set up a scheme, and they've got to make it inclusive and we've got to include everyone. Well, I'll tell you what, we're everyone, we're someone, and we can take advantage of some of this stuff, and we can pull out the resources we need, and we can use it for us and to improve ourselves, and work against them. But there are things that we can extract out of it. Yeah, it's a movement that I think is, its time has come. And there's so many groups doing it and thinking along these levels. And it was interesting watching Millennial this year, where people that aren't involved with land purchasing or whatever are still talking about the same sort of things. They're actually talking about parallel systems, about what we need to do is do things to ourselves. When Dave Martell was talking, you were saying about... It was probably 5-10 years ago when people were talking about payment processors. Wouldn't it be great if we had our own payment processors and our own, we've been kicking about for the last couple of years now, our own currency. How can we do this? Do we have to link it to a precious metal? Could it be a crypto? Does it have to be hard cash? How can we do this? And we're kind of working down that line. Within a couple of years, I can't see any reason why we won't have a workable currency that we can ring fence and use within our circles, which keeps all the money in our group. And that, it would be very, very good. That would be very powerful.
Yeah. See, one thing that I really like the idea of is getting money from our opponents and keeping it within our own community. So, for example, selling products to progressives and liberals and whatever, but then so they're giving us their money, but then we keep it. The opposite is the default, where we are giving our money to McDonald's and whatever, and so it's not staying within our community. It's not enriching our community.
This is the mindset we need, right? This is the mindset we need, which is, okay, does everyone like McDonald's? And I don't think most people do. But people like a fast food outlet, and it needs to be, okay, we need our own now. We need our own. But then we've got to agree that if we're going to all chip in and we're going to do this, we're going to start this, okay, that's the only one you use. Now we've got to start shaming people. And I've said this before as well, you know, these nationalists or people in our sphere, they start a business and people go, yeah, that's great. And then they don't use it. And they just end up struggling. If people start these businesses within our sphere, support them. Support them. There's no point saying, oh, I know, but, you know, their tea is, you know, it's a pound dearer than, yes, it is a pound dearer. Now put your hand in your pocket and go and pay for it, right? And if everybody did that, they'll be able to come down a pound in price.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Well, hopefully this is one function of Millennial, that it makes people aware of the different things that are going on. I hope it does, because I want people to be aware that you don't have to buy from the enemy. We can do these things ourselves. We can replicate these things. Kind of like with Russia, when actually with McDonald's, when it ended up creating its own...
Yeah,
it's just funny, but it's at that scale, it's obviously funny, but it is serious for us, because this would be a way for us to enrich our own.
I think we're just coming to terms with it, aren't we? I think the success we've had with alternative media, right, has actually spurred a lot of people on. I mean, what you've done with Millennial in the last decade, right, is actually make it an institution. It's a brand. It's something that people look forward to. It's really become a part of our culture now, which is really, really good. It's a cultural icon. But everything that's happening on the alternative media has wiped out mainstream media. So we should be very proud of what we've done there. And every time I see all these businesses starting up, you know, Imperium Press and the Biz Archives that you had on the other day, fantastic guys. I mean, if I buy books, I've got, you know, I'm trying to see, do our guys publish them? Are our guys writing them? I've foregone my old favourite authors, you know, and now I'm like, okay, let's see what our guys are writing. We've got to support the projects, ideas, content creators, right, and businesses that our people are putting together. If we do that, we've already got a parallel system. We've already got it nearly in place. All it needs now is for people to start promoting it properly, bringing it together, so that people know, okay, where are these things available? Where can I get my clothing? Where can I get my tea and coffee? Where can I get my vegetables? And start bringing other businesses in. You'd be surprised at the moment. I think a lot of these farm shops and a lot of these farmers, right, they're already talking to us, because we're saying, okay, we'll promote you. Well, maybe we can get them on board. Do you know what I'm saying? And just make this a system which is separate from the one that at the very best dislikes us.
Yeah, and hopefully that system would soon be too big to attack.
Yeah,
because it's too sprawling, it's too multifaceted and so on. So I think that would be a very good goal to have. I completely agree. I think this is something that has to happen, and I will facilitate it with Millennial. I'll have people on who are starting businesses, who are starting initiatives and so on. I'll certainly do that each year, because I think that's one way in which I can help. And I think it's also what people expect from Millennial now. As you said, it has, like, well, they expect it to make them aware of things that they weren't aware of before. That's one one thing that it does. As you said, it very kind words, thank you. This is the 10th year. It has become a sort of institution. It's become a tradition for people. There was somebody, I've forgotten the exact wording, but today I read someone saying that it's sort of replaced Christmas for them. And that's not what it was not quite that extreme. It was like it's absorbed. It's what he does for Christmas now.
Yeah, I kind of understand. But for me to say this has become cultural actually is a big thing. Because it's now become a part of the culture, and that's quite good. This isn't something that just goes on. It's a huge part for a lot of people. So you've done really, really well. You should be very proud of it.
Thank you. It is. I am very proud of it. Okay, but without going on too much about that, the other thing you wanted to talk about was what we ultimately want. And a couple of years ago, it was 2 years ago now, I gave a speech, and you and I talked about it on your millennial appearance that year, 22. And I think I went through the whole speech, and we were commenting on it as we went, and it ended up being a really fun stream, actually. But that, to give the background, I was asked by Nomos Events to speak at a conference in London. And so I did so. It had been quite a long time since I gave a speech. It was before COVID. So it was the only speech I've given since then. And they wanted that, like the theme that they came up with was, what do we want? That was what they asked me to speak about. So I thought, well, in very open terms, what do I want? And I thought, well, it's a vision of the future, a vision of a possible future for Britain. What is the best that, not that I think is easily feasible, but what is the best that I could want, that I could hope for 100 years from now, 200 years from now? I should probably have set it a bit further out, but whatever.
Well, I don't know. I think 100 years is a good mark. But I think what you hit on in that in your story, because it was a really good story as well. I liked it. I keep coming back to, okay, what is the ideal? Did we ever hit that ideal? And have we gone past it? Do we have to go backwards? And I don't think we do, because we can't literally put the toothpaste back in the tube. We can't take away technology. Now it's here. But I think there is an ideal. And I think the ideal was the English village. And I just think it was. I think it's idyllic. And if you think about it, so let's say 500 to 700 people. So you end up with a very high trust society at that number, because you either know everyone or you know someone who knows that person, and the families know each other. And a lot of the people in the village would work in the village or surrounding the village. The village would have had a farm on the outside of it, and that farm would have provided the food for that village. And you would have had a baker and a greengrocer. And all of these things. And I think as it gets bigger is when you start to lose that. It becomes not as good. So a large town, suddenly you don't have that high trust, because you don't know everyone, and you don't know their children, and you don't know their parents, because it's just too big. And once you get to a city, and I've heard this said so many times, that a city can be the loneliest place, because there's all these people and yet you know no one. So I think that pinnacle, that ideal, would be an English village. And it doesn't have to expand into a town. It should remain as it is. And you could have lots of villages instead of one big town. And they should be separated by green fields and farms that could provide the food for those villages. And it's just something that we could actually do. We could do that. So instead of rebuilding, maybe we tear some stuff down and literally put farms back and villages back. And that doesn't mean you can't have towns, because you can, because kids like to get out of the village and go to the town where it's much more lively and exciting. But I think you said in the speech, after a few years, a lot of those kids would yearn to return to the village. And that's why those villages need to remain the same. Because there's nothing worse, is there, when you go back to that, back to your hometown, and suddenly they've knocked down the library and put up some monstrosity, and nothing's the same, and it's 10 times as big. So there's a core in that speech you wrote that I think we can build on for a new future. I think you really hit on something important in there.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, that was the idea. I wrote it very quickly, as I recall, because I didn't have an idea until the very end, and then I wrote it very quickly. But it turned out very well, and this was the goal. It was to just paint a picture of a good life, a good world, a good society. This thing about lots of small things is so, it applies everywhere, because I think we seem to be in an age now, and for the last 100, 200 years, everything has been a process of getting larger and larger, things merging, lots of little things merging into one big thing. And I think a good analogy here, a good example of that is, and you'll think this will chime with you, in the 80s, 70s and 80s, and before that, we had lots of little production companies working around Britain, LWT, Thames, Granada, Southern Television, all of these, I can't remember them all, there are loads of them. And yes. Yeah. And what happened in the 80s, and this was something Thatcher did, is that she gave them permission to buy each other up. And so that ended up with, I think within 10 years, by 95, I'm pretty sure, that ended up with one single big company. Which then merged with the channel that was broadcasting all of the work, ITV. So now it's just one single thing. Yeah. So all of these little companies that had their own, each one had its own way of working, its own style, all of them, it's all gone.
Yeah.
How is that good? How is that better? As someone would say, well, it's because the one big company now has loads of resources. Yeah. But they had the necessary resources. They had the resources they needed back then, in order to make loads of good stuff. So how is this better? The end product is certainly not better.
And it's never better for us, is it?
No.
The only people that was better for is the one company that ends up owning everything, which is always the way, isn't it? And it's and we end up with something that's just not as good.
Yeah,
it's just not as good. All of those smaller things.
Either. It's not as inspiring. When you think about one big company instead of lots of little companies, I think the latter is just inherently more life-affirming and interesting.
Well, it's the same as if you go to a gallery and there's 100 different artists' work, and you can look around and you can say, I like that, I like the style of this one, I like them, I love that. And you can, and it's great. If you were walk into a gallery and it's, everything is the same, it's done. It's like, okay, well, that's that then. The same picture by the same artist on every wall, and, you know, what is the point?
Yeah, exactly. And you can say, well, but that one artist is really rich. Well, for what?
Yeah, great.
That's the equivalent. That's an analogy, and obviously it appeals to me because I'm into drama, TV drama. But the same thing applies. I would like things to be compatible. Well,
the beauty of that, lots of small things as well. When you look at the villages, what you would find as well is that one village would be a certain way, and it would attract a certain group of people. And we kind of had this like that within the arts movement. Okay, if you go way back, you had places where. Well, that's where all the artists go in that one. And that one over there is where all the poets go. And that one over there is where all the, you know, this is where the builders hang out and the engineers hang out. Because, and you end up with all of these places where you could go, do you know what, I don't really fit in here, but I could go over to this one, which is full of people just like me, and I feel much better off over here. Whereas if you just cram everything together, you don't get that. It doesn't work. You just end up, everyone just feels, I don't know anyone.
Yeah, yeah. You would actually end up with diversity, dare I use the word.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but you would. And it would actually, it would be organic, homegrown diversity, but the variety of the British people. Well, and yes, each village would have its own character and its own economy, its own trades and so on. Well, absolutely. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons that I think Lord of the Rings is so, it has such a treasured place in people's lives and in their headspace. It's because it harks back to this England. It's also why the Industrial Revolution was lamented by some people, because they knew it signaled the end of the English village, the rural economy, that being the default way of life. Now you've got big industrial towns and then cities. Well, you can understand why they were right to lament that.
Yeah. There was a lot of good that came out of the Industrial Revolution. But the same as any double-edged sword, there was also a hell of a lot of bad that happened at that period. But I think we need to look forward as well. A lot of people misunderstand me when I look back and talk about like an English village or the farm or being self-sufficient, and they're like, oh, he must detest technology. And I don't. I really, really don't. I say it every time. I'm quite a fan of technology. I'm not a fan of the way the people in charge of things at the moment are using technology. But I think that we're so ingenious. We've come up with all of these ways, but we need to find a balance. And I think moving forward, that's going to be a key word, which is we have to find balance. Life cannot be all about comfort and convenience, because otherwise you're going to end up in a mobility scooter because it's more convenient than walking. Just getting someone else to push protein pills into your face because it's more convenient than cooking, and you're comfortable. That's not living. That's not life. So maybe, you know, sometimes maybe we need to be told, yes, but you know, for 2 hours a week, you should be chopping wood, like for your wood burner, or you need to get onto this land and you need to help us. We're going to do a couple of hours digging on a Sunday, because not everything can be comfort and convenience. And technology tends to be aimed at our striving always for something to be more convenient and for us to be more comfortable. And I think we need to balance that. And I think that's been forgotten a lot. We hear a lot about people saying, you know, spend too much time online and you need to do this and you need to do that. And it's true. We do need to find that balance. And hopefully, you know, that's something that we can do with all of this land. Because I can tell you, when people get down there, they're not sat on their phones. They're sat talking. What can we do? What about this? Can we do something for the kids? What about building steps down to that stream? Suddenly, we're back in the real world. And I can tell you, blokes love that. Within 10 minutes of being there, blokes are looking at, well, what, we could do this and we could do that. It's it's a good thing, and it is a good balance.
Yeah. And of course, in the normal world, men don't have the freedom, that freedom, because there's all the bureaucracy and some manager who's a soulless automaton, all of that to prevent. It's actually, I think it's quite deliberate to prevent male ingenuity and initiative. I think a lot of modern culture is just that, funneled one way or another. So when a man has land, he has the freedom to do things with it, including improving it and making it more useful, more comfortable, more pleasant, more productive. So, of course, when a man, as you say, stands on that land for the first time, yeah, his imagination will be fired. He'll be thinking, well, we could do this, we could do that. What, why is that that way? And so forth. So this is the kind of thing that I think a lot of men grow up assuming they will have one day, but then the modern world, one way or another, robs them of it or deprives them of it, and doesn't prepare them for what's necessary in order to seize it, in order to get it. So this is why I think something like the Woodlander Initiative is so good, because it intervenes and gives people a possible way to have that freedom, to have that independence. I think it's just a tremendous idea.
It does. I'll be honest. A lot of people, even at my age, a lot of people my age, and I'm as old as the hills, kind of had things stolen from them. That they had dreams. They wanted that, and they wanted this, and they never got it. So to be able to give people the chance to get something, to be part of something, to own something, is a really good thing. But for the younger people who are now growing up thinking, I will never own a house, ever. The amount of people below the age of 30 I speak to who are just like, well, that's an impossibility. That's just never going to happen. To be able to give them that choice and say, well, I'll tell you what, how would you like to own your own piece of land? They would never be able to afford it. Well, we've got a way you can. And once you've got it, we'll talk about what you can do with it. And it's yours. That can fire the imagination. That can get them thinking, really? I can actually own something that's mine that no one can take away. Yes, you can. And you won't be in debt for 30 years either. We'll get it done in a year. That's powerful.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's great. I like the idea of that last thing you said there as well, because it, a year, maybe 2 years, maybe 6 months. It's a small time frame, so it's not terrifying for a young person to think in those terms. Very good, very good. I think one last thing is, we were talking earlier before we went on air about the Shire and the Lord of the Rings. Also, the image of a cottage with a fireplace, logs, chopped locally, and it keeps you warm. The thing is, it sounds cutesy and oldie-worldy for the sake, kind of indulgent, but there's a reason we keep having this dream. There's a reason we keep harking back to the traditional Christmas, the Christmas in the town square with the snow and the church spire and the red pillar box and so forth. It's because that world was better than the world we're living in now. Even whatever the costs of it, whatever the hardships that existed then, yes, of course, medicine was nowhere near as good then. Technology was nowhere near as good then, sure. But we can keep
the medicine, we can keep the technology, but we don't have to get rid of the cottages. We don't have to destroy the villages. In fact, we can have more of those. Well, we built them then, we can build them now, but not these mock Tudor things they did in the 1980s that they were throwing up, housing estates, hundreds of mock Tudor houses.
Well, just awful. Even that... Even that is preferable to the new build housing estate.
Yeah, I know. But we could have this. We could have it. And it gets back to what I just said, which was, I think there wasn't, we reached that pinnacle at that village, which had the farm, that provided the food, that had the small shops, and people knew each other. And I think as those things grew into towns, we lost some of that. Which is why the villages, I mean, round where I live, there's still loads of little villages with thatched cottages and little rows of houses. And they're stunningly beautiful, but out of the price range of anyone, because that's where everyone wants to live. Because the minute you go there, you just think, this is perfect. It's got the little village green and a duck pond. that's now priceless, literally priceless.
I know that you watched my talk about Edna, the inebriate woman. So I'll put up a screenshot from that. And this is her in a village walking past a little shop, just as you just described.
Yeah.
And it's just lovely. I mean, I don't know how anyone could say, oh, no, this needs to be a glass and steel monstrosity. This has to be replaced somehow. You'd have to be a complete monster. This is the English village. I mean, there are other photos I could show that are even more pleasant, even more picturesque. But it's not a fiction. This is the thing. What you'll hear nowadays is, oh, no one ever actually lived like that. It was never actually nice. the whole thing about no one has ever been happy ever. Yeah. But no, this really was. I mean, there'll be people watching this stream who grew up in a village just like that in the 70s. So it absolutely was real. And still is real. But as you say, it's costs a fortune now.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I've had quite a lot of people, they contact me and they say, you know, can we meet for a coffee? And I'd love to see where you live. So they come down, I'll show them around and I'll have a coffee. And a chap came down and we were talking about, you know, how the difference between authenticity and complete fake. So I took him up one road in the town nearest me, and it's an old town, it's an old market town, and there is one road which is the main road into town, and it's for me, it's beautiful. I love it because I can see a progression. All the roof site heights are different. You've got a little row of cottages, and then you've got a house, and then an old pub, or what used to be a pub, and you've got a little few shops and some detached cottages, and then you've got a few manor houses. And I said, if you look even at the terraced ones, you'll see that these three were built at 1 year, and the ones next door, which are 3 foot higher, were probably built about 20 years later, yet they're joined on. And you can see the difference in architecture, and it's all very, very British. And this one over here was obviously a school at some time. And it's just in one road, and I love it. And I said, but if you turn left off of this road, you'll be in a 1979 housing estate where every house is absolutely identical. They're hideous. And that is the difference between authenticity, where something grows gradually, and people, even if things are at different heights and the architecture is slightly different, it was done in such a way that actually they complement each other. It looks fine. And that housing estate is completely fake. It was built in one go, all the same. The only thing that mattered was profit for the builder. That's it. And that's not how things work. Or should. No. It is how they work. But.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be publishing an essay sometime next year about my hometown, and I talk about this exact kind of thing a lot in that, and I detail the history of it. That's why it's taking a long time to write, because I'm having to do a lot of research, but I want to get it right. And this is the kind of thing where they would demolish buildings that were hundreds of years old, but they complemented each other. They were fine and lovely as well, pleasant. They demolished those and put up some dreadful thing that's been hated ever since in the center of Linlithgow. But anyway, that's a whole thing. I don't want to, I'm just saying I will be writing about this kind of thing. And not with, I mean, obviously it is depressing, but I don't want to depress. I want to analyze and find out, how did this happen? And what was lost? What, like, looking at it almost scientifically. Because I don't want to just, I mean, it depresses me as well. So I don't want to depress people. I want it to be, there to be a point to doing that. But just to return to the Shire and the cottage and so on, I've also got these images to show. That's from The Snowman, 1982. Again, why would you not want that? And then this is from a book by Shirley Hughes. Again, this is something I grew up with. And it's a wee boy with his grandpa, the Christmas tree and all this. It's just, this I think is what we need to strengthen and return to. And anything that gets in the way of that, whether it's consumerism, globalism, atheism, nihilism, whatever it is the enemy. All of them are. And The Woodlander, we should wrap up now because I've got a red ice on in a few minutes. I'm sorry that your stream started much later than usual, but I thought it was just necessity with the UK column. Is there anything though that you would like to say in before we finish?
I am. The Woodlander Initiative is not just me. I have got a group of people that it wouldn't work without them. So I've got people behind the scenes working on the website. I've got Joe, the Wessex Nomad, who does tremendous work behind the scenes. I couldn't have done any of it. I've also got a whole group of people on my Telegram channels who do the moderating, and just keep everything going. They're good friends. I've met most of them. It's not one person, and I know it's kind of directed at me because I started it, and it's the Woodlander Initiative.
You're the Klaus Schwab of this.
Yes, I've got a cat to be stroking in a minute. It's not me. There's a team of people, but I'm going to finish with this. The aim is to get 1,000 members, 1,000 members who are willing to say, do you know what? I'll put in £1,000 if this is going where I think it's going. We've got about 400 to 500 members already. So if anybody is watching this and you're not a member, join up. Check out the website. Help us do this because it's a positive step in the right direction for us. And it's working already.
Yeah, it definitely is a step in the right direction. I completely agree. We will do Super Chats. Thank you for reminding me. I nearly forgot. Okay, Enlightened Despot said, one of the dramatic losses produced by modernity is that land is not passed on. Even a peasant in the Middle Ages passes on his land to his children. This was shattered. The boomers shattered this, thinking of land only as a way of paying off debt. This is a major loss of power. That's a whole thing. I remember seeing the photo of a peasant's cottage, I think in Bavaria, and some middle class hipster in San Diego is now living in a box. That's what he can manage, whereas a peasant 100 years ago could actually have a large cottage. I mean, it's quite astonishing, and I'm sure it's not typical, but it's nonetheless the point is made. Okay, HAL 9000, you've just got to look at the promoters of AI and the futurist agenda, Zuckerberg, Thiel, Harari, Schwab, for example, to know that there's something very unhealthy about it. A lot of these people are freaky, for want of a better word. So I agree. Okay, and Monty Fontaine asks, what would you say are the top 5 pieces of parallel infrastructure we need to develop? Great stream. Thanks again for sorting out the Woodlander Initiative. So that's a very good question. What are the top five pieces of parallel infrastructure that we need?
I'll give you the four things you've got to have. And this is not the parallel work, but this is what we need. You need water, food, shelter, and company. And all of that is possible if you've got your own land. If you've got your own land, you can start your own business, right? So business, you then into commerce. And you've got to be self-sufficient. You can't be reliant on things from outside, okay? And you can do that when you've got people with you and you can work together. So get land, get people that are like you to join with you, right? And anything is possible.
All right. Very good. Very inspiring words there. Okay. Black Pigeon Pilled. What does Woodlander make of his Sopranos malapropism being memed into existence? Merry Christmas and good Yule, you two. Do you know about this?
I have no idea what he's talking about. He's a great guy. He's a great guy with a fantastic name.
Yes. Yes, indeed. That, I know that that came from you in the first one. Yeah. He also said, I got called a collapse bro for defending the Woodlander Initiative, even though, as Woz said, nothing could be so obvious as nationalism and land ownership. You've more patience than me, Simon. Best luck with it for 2025. That's great. Thank you very much, Black Pigeon Pilled. And Tish 13 made a nice donation. Thank you very much. I think that was all of them. Oh, yes. Diesel Runaway said, inspiring stream. Thanks to you both. Well, thank you very much, Diesel. All right. That's it for this stream. It's a bit shorter than I would have liked, but I think nonetheless we've had a. I think it's been good. I think it's been useful. I hope you feel the same, Simon.
Yeah, it's been really good. Thank you very much, Colin.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, well, I'll be back shortly with Red Ice. I think it's only Henrik who's appearing because Lana's not feeling well. But that'll be in about 5 minutes. Simon, the Woodlander, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
No problem. See you soon.
All right.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.